Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're very welcome to Audiovisual Cultures, the podcast that explores different areas of film, the arts and media. I am Paula Blair, and for this episode, it was my great pleasure to speak in person to Joanna Leach in her guise as Programme Manager at the Strand Arts Centre in East Belfast, and to cultural freelancer Robert J.E. Simpson. The following conversations were recorded on location at The Strand. First, you'll hear from all three of us talking about The Strand, its history, present and hopes for its future. Then more about Robert and the different aspects to what he does. And finally, Robert and I chat quite generally about things springing from the location and having just watched Thor: Love and Thunder. And do note, we mention plot details, so if you want to avoid spoilers, best bookmark this episode for after you've seen the film. My huge thanks to our generous patrons, without whom I would not be able to keep making this show and providing it for free. If you can join them and want to access exclusive bonus material, including outtakes that will have come from these recordings, have a look at our membership options at patreon.com/avcultures. You can also head over to our website at audiovisualcultures.com and drop one-off donations of any amount you choose, and use the buttons to make one-off donations of any amount. If you can't do that, sharing this episode with a friend and giving us a nice review wherever you access this podcast would be much appreciated. Okay, I really hope you enjoy this one. It was great to crack to record. So it is most delightful to be in Strand Arts Centre, where I fell in love with the cinema. Many years ago, as a very small child, because I grew up down the road on Hollywood Road, and I'm here as well with my really great pals, Robert J.E. Simpson and Joanna Leach, who is the programmer, aren't you? Yes, you can tell us all about what you do at The Strand. Joanna has been on the podcast before, quite a while ago, talking about one of her art projects, but today she'll be speaking a wee bit in her guise as a programmer at The Strand. And it was really cool to be able to meet up with Robert from CinePunked, and he's very kindly let me talk at him on CinePunked before. So yeah, it's really cool to be here with both of you. It's really special to me that we're all here, so thank you both for doing this.
Thank you. I don't think the three of us have been in the same room together before.
I know, yeah, it's like we've known each other all for so long in various different, you know, vices, but like, yeah, so this is great.
Yeah. So Joanna, would you be happy to give us a bit of your spiel about The Strand? Because it's a really old cinema. It's one of Belfast's, it's the last standing Art Deco cinema. And it was known as The Strand Cinema for a very long time. And then it was rejuvenated as the Strand Arts Centre. So would you be able to just give us a bit more detail about that?
Yeah, so the Strand is on Hollywood Road in East Belfast, Northern Ireland. And yes, as Paula said, we are the oldest cinema left in Northern Ireland, and the last pre-existing kind of wartime building. And it's from 1935. We have four screens currently. It used to be one theatre. And when we became the Art Centre a few years ago, it just meant we were able to get rates relief for the building and be able to get charitable funds to help us change from 35mm film to digital. And apart from that, the Strand for a time was a variety theatre. So we've been able to use the stage again and kind of add on all the creative things that we do. So sometimes we'll have like circus performers before a film, and then sometimes we'll be doing just straight up like comedy or theatre. But film is still our first love, and we have film clubs for younger people and older people. And we're hoping to refurb next year, and we've got 4 out of the 6 million that we need. And that's just to put whole new electrics in here, disability access, and lots of new bits and pieces that people will enjoy.
Fantastic, thank you. And Robert, you've done a few events here. You've host, and you've been doing Q&As and lots of different things. So what's your experience with The Strand?
Well, like you, this would have been my local cinema when I was a kid. Although we weren't big cinema goers, which is ironic considering how much time I spend watching film today. So I certainly remember coming here as a kid, and so it's got that kind of nice, warm, fuzzy feeling of family, because that's when we actually were all together in a room, relatively quiet. And I distinctly remember coming here to see Muppet's Christmas Carol, and my teacher from primary one sitting behind me, and I hadn't seen her for years, so that's just a vague memory that I have. As a venue, I think it's fascinating. I love the history, so I'm really into sort of film history, and I've been wandering around the UK taking photographs and visiting old cinema sites when I can, and that this is still a functional Art Deco 1930s cinema in Belfast, I think, is fantastic. Now, we still had, there are still a few other cinemas in the city repurposed from similar kind of period, but this still retains a lot of its character. So that has a lot of appeal. Mm. It's a nice space to work. There are four very different screens. I've mostly done stuff in the tiny screen that we're in here, screen 4, and screen 2, which is quite a big one with the nice big stage. And I love that screen. I just love the feel of it. I love the acoustics in the room. I love the shape of the room. Mm-hmm. And I love that it's got that big, deep performing space with the screen behind it. So you can sit in the front row and the screen isn't too close to you. Because mm-hmm. I went to the cinema mm-hmm. somewhere else in a multiplex the other week and sat in row 1 and deeply regretted it the whole way through as I kind of craned my neck at 45 degrees. But it's a great place that's littered with history, and I think it gets forgotten about because it's not in the city centre. It's in this sort of middle ground between here and like proper suburbia. Mm-hmm. So people overlook it a little bit. And certainly that's always my impression. If you say, you know, like there's some stuff on the Strand, people go, where's that? Mm-hmm. Or at least the people that I talk to that are not from East Belfast. Anyone from East Belfast knows where it is. So I think it's a little gem, and mm-hmm. I like its package of stuff. Mm-hmm. I always want to do more stuff here, but it's trying to get the opportunities to do it and the funding and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. It's not so easy.
Yeah, great. Yeah, it's a very special place to me. It was the first cinema I would have gone to, and I can't remember what the earliest films I saw were, but I've had really fundamental film viewing experiences here. So I saw Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas, and that was just a few weeks after my dad died, so that was a really special experience for me. And I think you and I do, I think we went to see it again as adults, but I think it was in the QFT, if I remember correctly. We saw it together in the QFT, but that was a film we've bonded over quite a lot over the years as well when we were teenagers. So there was that. And I also, when I was far too young, went to see Jurassic Park here as well. And I had to run off to the toilets when the clever girl sequence was happening because I was too wee. I was too scared. I didn't watch that properly till I was about 14. And I was 8 when I came to see it here. So
it is scary.
Yeah.
And yeah, they're still pumping those out, but still, you know, like the first ones are the best.
So it's a special wee place. And yeah, so I just want to encourage anybody who's ever living in Belfast but not in the East, or visiting Belfast ever, check it out, because there's always such great things. I mean, just last week you had the Rocky Horror Picture Show and had an amazing night here, and you've always got gigs on. There's traditional Irish music, but there's also you know, things that might appeal to all different parts of the community, I think. And as you say, there's circus and there's comedy nights and there's all sorts of things. So yeah, absolutely check it out. It's really special. Either of you want to add anything?
I mean, to that I would say that it's the... There's an authenticity about the Strand that I don't think you get necessarily in other cinemas, and it is that tie-in with the history of the site.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a multiplex experience here, even though it's got multiple screens. It's something different. It feels like you're literally taking in that nearly 90 years of history here. I don't know, for me, that sort of stuff resonates more. It feels like that's an important thing to maintain. And my worry about a place like this, I mean, it's great to hear that you've got the funding, you know, or a lot of the funding that you need in order to kind of just jazz the place up a little bit more and improve it, because it's, so many of these places do get lost over time. I'm on various groups online, and when you kind of read about another cinema that's been torn down or left abandoned, or they couldn't get the funding, or the local clients have just said, no, we don't need it. And it's a little bit of the kind of the culture of the area that's gone. So this is a special place, and it is important that it gets maintained. It's important that it gets used and that people take a chance on it.
Mm. I feel like it's important for East Belfast to have nice things and for it to have nice cultural things, because for a very long time it felt like we weren't really allowed to have nice things or nice cultural things or enjoy those things if we did have them. So I feel like even slightly politically, it's a very important space to protect and to nurture for those reasons as well.
And I just think it's a real shame for other communities, like throughout Belfast, because, you know, if North Belfast, West Belfast, South Belfast would have had places like the Strand at their fingertips, you know, just down the road. And that's the thing that I love here, is that I live here and I work here. You know, I can just walk around the corner or, you know, go to a gig here and not have to go in and out of the city centre. But the Strand has also always been like a place for everybody. So even like historically, like throughout the Troubles and things, you would have had a mixed group of people coming here, because we'd have people from the Short Strand would have walked up, or because of things being closed in the city centre with like curfews, the Strand would still be open. So we've kind of been that place that people can go, and it doesn't matter where you're from, you're all going to sit down and have this experience together. And I think, you know, that's like what Robert was saying, is that kind of feel of like family, because either you came with your family or the cinema became your family. Mm-hmm. So for individuals and for people, maybe he also had been through traumas after wartime as well. A lot of people said that when they came to the cinema, they'd be able to like let all of their kind of excess baggage go, and for their mental health it was really important. So we have a project called Strand Stories, which we're starting to collect all these stories. Or, you know, we were talking to someone who was hurt, their parent was deaf, so they would sign the film to their parent, and then she was worried that she wouldn't get all of the kind of plots, but the, you know, her mom was just so happy to be in a space, and happy that she was in a space where, you know, she didn't need to do anything or be a certain person, she could just come and be entertained. So entertainment is the most important thing.
It's escapism, isn't it? Really? I mean, the cinema is always escapism. I think Northern Ireland, we needed it. I mean, it's one of the things that I loved about Kenneth Branagh's Belfast was they escaped. He escapes to the cinema. I mean, fair enough, most of it was Hammer horror films, so like it was ticking my boxes, but it just sort of reminded you that's the way that we kind of avoided, or it's the way some of us have avoided the traumas that were going on during that time. I happened to be looking at doing a bit of research the other night, looking through some old Kinematograph weeklies, and there was a list of the cinemas in Northern Ireland in 1957. I happened to look at it, and it's dozens and dozens, and now we're down to, I don't know, how many cinemas have you got in Belfast now? Maybe half a dozen in total. It's really depressing. So they are little time capsules. And I know you guys do tours and stuff here as well, and showing off that history to folk. And I've seen photographs from people who've gone off on those tours, and they're picking out little details. And I'm like, this stuff that you're seeing, this stuff, and you're getting into it, and you're reliving these stories that otherwise, you know, we kind of just walk past.
I think that would be a nice little opener. Yeah, happy enough for that. Great.
Just
going to
go up a Strand.
Yeah. up a Strand. Well, thank you so much, Joanna, for your time. That's really kind of you.
If you find text useful with your podcasts, we've got two options for you. You can subscribe to Audiovisual Cultures Podcast on YouTube for captioned videos, and you can visit audiovisualcultures.com and click the transcripts tab. Both sites are linked in the show notes, along with information about this episode.
Robert J. Simpson.
Yes.
Hello.
Hello.
It's so good to see you.
Did you?
It's being in a room with you and not on a computer screen.
This is the weird thing about social media and the way that our world works now is that you can feel that you are with someone a lot more than you actually are just because you have got the computer screens and your Facebook updates and all the rest of it. And we've done a couple of podcasty type things together, so it doesn't feel like it's that long since I've seen you, but it probably is.
Yeah. And we saw each other in person last, I think it was probably about October 2019.
No.
That's wild.
No.
Yeah, it was.
That's scary.
Because I haven't been here in all that time.
Wow.
And it's now August 2022.
Wow.
It's like a whole other decade.
We haven't changed.
In some ways we have, and in some ways we haven't. Let's just leave it at that, shall
we? This is true, yes. The trauma of the pandemic.
Yeah. Now, I would love for my listeners to learn more about you, because I have mentioned you, and we've done an in-conversation, but I put that out on my personal YouTube that wasn't on the podcast, and I've done Cinepunked, which was very kind of you to have me on, because I basically invited myself.
Oh, you were on the list anyway. I mean, you're on my list for asking again. I'm just trying to work out what to bring you on for.
Yeah, well, I think we're at a point where it's just any time, let's just try and find a way of doing things together, you know, because we are quite easily set up for online stuff, but it's just really great to do this in person.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so would you be happy to, well, I think what I'll do is I'm going to throw a bunch of stuff out there of my perception of all loads of things that you do, because I don't know how to describe you, but you do loads of stuff, so I'm going to just say that you research and write about film,
maybe
films, you run Cinepunked, you make Cinepunked podcasts, and you do the website and everything, which is class. And it's really great if you subscribe to that, because there's really great blogs by both Robert and Rachel, who's also working on Cinepunked.
Yeah.
You are an artist. You draw. Don't even laugh at that, right? You're an artist. You draw. I think you do. Don't you do some painting?
You're
doing some sculpture at the minute, which is fun.
Yeah.
You're a collector.
Yeah. All these things are true.
You're an enthusiast. You're, I would say, an expert on Hammer and on comedy, and not just comedy and film, but comedy very generally. You're an enthusiast, an expert. You've got loads of friends in that world.
I have a few.
I've chucked a load of stuff out, which is the things I feel like I know about. So are you happy to meander and take us through some things?
Yeah, I mean, I realise I do an awful lot of stuff. I got given advice when I was a teenager. I met a friend who became a very, very firm friend for many years, who told me just to focus on one thing, because it would mean it was easier to work out what I do. And I stupidly ignored that advice and carried on dabbling in as many things as I possibly could. If I was being generous about myself, I think the word is polymath. But the other way of looking at it is jack of all trades, master of none, depending on whether I'm feeling self-deprecating or not at the time. I generally just describe it as I work freelance in the arts. That's where I am at the moment. I mean, I also act and perform,
I've been doing
a lot this year, which I thoroughly enjoy. Yeah, I do a bit of art. I kind of hadn't for a long time. I'd done a lot of photography. I kind of got back into it during the pandemic, and I have an exhibition coming up in a couple of weeks, which is nerve-wracking, because it's the first time I've done a solo show of like my actual handcrafted artworks. And a lot of it is portraits, and a lot of them are inspired by a live show that I did called A Comedy of Madness, which was all about comedy and mental health. And I did that with my friends Robert Ross and Tony Slattery, and we did that a couple of times. We were doing it before pandemic, and then pandemic hit, so it hasn't been touched, but I've still been thinking about a lot of the themes, and over the pandemic I've kind of gone back into that safe nostalgia of things that I loved growing up. So I do that. I do film research and history. I've done it for a long time. That's what I trained at university. I was an archivist and things as well. I've done a lot of work for Hammer Films over the years, but I've not had an official connection with them for quite some time, although I'm still researching their company history, and have a book that I'm working on at the moment that I hope will come out, if I'm lucky, before the end of the year, on their kind of distribution end, the exclusive films stuff. Well, so I do. And then Cinepunked, which is sort of my driving thing these days. That's me and Dr. Rachel Kelly. Got to give her a full title, or she'll shout at me. I don't give you yours.
Don't worry about that.
Dr. P.
I just like gender neutral titles. it's not a reason to do a PhD, but it's
pretty good.
It's a pretty good one. Yeah,
so Rachel and I that kind of steer a lot of that. Probably more me these days because Rachel has she's got a writing career and stuff of her own and other things and family. And that's basically a project that's about using film to, I always describe it as like using film to open up conversation. So it's ostensibly an organization that talks about film, but actually we're trying to do something more. We're trying to look at social conditions. We're trying to look at sort of thoughts and life and stuff and use the film as a way to open those conversations, as a way to find an ingress into sometimes difficult topics. I mean, we've done stuff about censorship, we've done stuff about pornography, we've done stuff about gaslighting, we've done a number of things about mental health, all stemming through that lens of projecting a film. Everyone feels safe in film. You know, it's like, oh, it's a film. But you can actually kind of get under the skin of quite a lot of stuff. So we do that, and you know, we've got our podcast, we've gone into publishing now as well, and we do live events. That's what we kind of did our bread and butter on for pre-pandemic. Haven't had much happening since, but we're trying to get back into it again. Yeah, I do all these things. I find it very weird talking about it though.
And you do them very well, and you do some really class stuff. We're going to go and see Thor, whichever one it is that's out, in a minute, so and have a wee bit of lunch. But we're going to talk a bit more afterwards, hopefully. Maybe about the film, but we can chat about you, because I don't know how interesting this film's going to be.
Well, I've no idea. I'll say before we go in that I'm not a Marvel aficionado.
See, neither am I, which I think in a way is quite interesting, because what if we come up with something, you know, or it might just be we won't talk about the film itself, but we just keep having a wee chat about you and your stuff
I've seen a few of them. I haven't seen the whole cycle of films, so it's going to be fairly open-ended for me. Although I still find it ironic that from someone who's not really a comic book nerd, that the first commentary track that I did for a Blu-ray release was for a Marvel film.
Oh really?
I did Howard the Duck.
Did you?
I asked to do that, which was kind of strange. But it is actually a Marvel film. So, I mean, you know, my relationship with these films is in flux, put it that way.
Yeah, because I'm a big Spider-Man fan, so I had seen all the Sam Raimi's, but then that was really exclusively Sony for such a long time. And then now it's been sort of drawn in to the MCU, so I'm sort of catching up a little bit because I'm into Spider-Man. But I haven't seen the sort of big Avengers films or anything. I know stuff about what's happened and things like that, but I've just been dipping in and out. You know, I've seen the second Guardians of the Galaxy film. You know, I haven't done this, and I've seen Thor Ragnarok, but I have not seen Thor.
Okay, so, well, I've seen neither of those, so
Ragnarok's pretty fun. I liked it, so I think it's sort of a, I think this is a sequel because it's Taika Waititi, so it's sort of Marvel adjacent is what I am aware of, but we'll see what happens. I think there's loads of cameos and stuff that should be quite fun. I'm just happy to go in open-minded and have a laugh with this
escapism for a couple of hours, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and Joanna very kindly supplied us with complimentary tickets because we have both done stuff for the Strand before and sometimes unpaid, so you know, it's nice to just get some comps and, you know, be able to do this and just to up the Strand a little bit.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we'll do that and we'll see you later.
Big thanks to our generous patrons at patreon.com/AVCultures for keeping us going. If you're not already supporting us, you're missing out on behind the scenes content, exclusive audio, and early releases. As well as being justifiably smug for helping out an indie podcaster sharing free education, you can see all my mistakes and get extras no one else is hearing all straight to your inbox or personal RSS feed. Join the pod today at patreon.com/AVCultures.
Long time since I was up in this room. Was it they called it the ballroom for a long time?
I have no idea.
I feel like it was called the ballroom. I don't know why. Maybe I'm wrong. But anyway, it's the big space that's upstairs in Strands at J Joanna has very kindly let us use to just have a bit more of a chat, and we've got some nice artwork, some nice couple of nice paintings of the strands and photos and things. But other than that, this has been a dance studio today for, was it a production of Hairspray that's coming?
So
there was a lot of activity in this. It was very sweaty in here earlier. But yeah, now it's just very quiet, and it's just me and Robert having a wee chat and staring at the holes in the ground where there used to be a hotel and a pub. And it's very weird because those were here for all of my life.
Forever.
It's quite odd.
The city keeps on changing. I suppose you've been away for so long. It's.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I still live within a few miles of here, but I'm not down in this little bit that often.
Yeah.
So it is strange seeing. Yeah. Saying a little different.
Totally. We're just out of Thor, Love and Thunder. I thought it was quite good crack.
You were laughing away.
I was. I heard you.
There's the kids in the front row who were kind of like, my God. I thought, am I going to have to put on my adult voice and go and shout at them?
I think they seem to settle down. I figured, do you know what? It's going to be such a loud, crashy, bangy film that they'll drown them out because they're right at the front. And it did mostly.
They were okay after about 5 minutes.
The first few minutes were a bit, they took them a while to set. I suspect they thought they were on their own. I think when they realised there was people.
Do you think?
Maybe, that I suspect, because, I think they thought they were totally on their own.
Well, it was when they were talking about whether or not there was jump scares in the film, because there was obviously something at the start about, like, mild horror.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, can I do a jump scare on them? I thought, no, I better not, because someone will end up reporting me and I'll get arrested.
You have to be careful, you can't play pranks on kids anymore. No. What is this?
I mean, like, it's terrible, because as kids, obviously, you know, people would do things to you. You wait all your life to kind of be able to do it back, and
it's illegal.
Yeah.
Oh, the 1990s, we miss you. Obviously, we're joking.
No! I miss some of that stuff.
Yeah,
I enjoyed it. I thought it was good fun.
Yeah.
I don't know the films well enough to be invested in Thor and be annoyed at anything.
Sure.
So for me, it was just like, I was quite entertained for a couple hours.
Yeah, I think very similar for me. I haven't really, I think we were talking about this earlier, I have only ever dipped in and out a little bit of the MCU. So I don't really remember who most of these people are most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just remember there was a funny rock creature in Ragnarok. And it was voiced by Taika Waititi, who also directed both of these films. That was all I remembered about Ragnarok. Like, and it was only they did that little skit, was it with Sam Neill? And was that Matt Damon? And
yes, it was Matt Damon. I don't know who the third one was.
It looked like somebody who was probably Matt Damon's brother. They looked really alike, but they were playing, Loki and Thor and
Odin
in this wee crappy play at Asgard, reenacting a lot of it. And I was like, oh, no, it's familiar. I think that happened in Ragnarok. or something. That was quite funny. And Melissa McCarthy as the, I can't remember that character at all. So there we are. I do think there was some sort of portal and a big scary lady came out of it, but that's all I remember. As you say, I haven't been that invested. And Guardians of the Galaxy, I've only seen the second one. I just laugh like a drain through that too. It's like good soundtrack, funny action, grand. Couple of hours nicely passed.
I think that's it. For most of the Marvel films, that's how I feel. I mean, I do kind of get a little bit frustrated with the abundance of characters.
Mm-hmm.
I still think, for me being a kind of old school film fan, it's like the Universal monster movies where it was a law of diminishing returns as they crammed everybody in.
Mm.
It seems to be working for the Marvel stuff, but it also means that sometimes it's my focus is too spread.
Yeah.
Just give me a character and a villain and let me work through that, please. Thank you very much. But it was fine. I mean, I didn't need the backstories for most of the characters, but it was fine. Nice bit of sentimentality in it and, dying people, little tears.
Mm.
I felt myself welling up at certain emotional responses.
It was. They worked through a lot of grief, I think.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen Thor, which I feel a bit bad about because, you know, I do have a very special place in my heart for Kenneth Branagh, of course, who directed it. But I haven't seen all of his films. I haven't even seen Belfast yet. I need to see it. I just never got around to it, really.
Why have you not seen Belfast?
Well, it didn't come out for ages in Newcastle. And then it was barely shown anywhere in Newcastle at one time. So, and I wasn't feeling okay about going to the cinema when it came out. So I'm just waiting and I'll watch it when I can cope with it, you know, because I know that it would probably only make me feel super homesick as well. So, you know, I find films from here a bit different. Like, there's times when I've watched Good Vibrations and I've been watching it maybe for research purposes, and it's really emotionally overwhelming because I'm going, Celia Center, I can't go there because they can't. You know,
the good news is most of Belfast wasn't actually shot in Belfast. So,
yeah, well, that's true. Yeah, they could. It was one of those like 70 ones like that where they just couldn't because it doesn't look like that anymore because they got blown up quite a lot of it.
That, and you probably don't want to stick the British Army and anyone dressed in a British Army outfit into the flats at the falls.
Well, exactly. So there's still issues. Anyway, so that's a whole other ramble. But yeah, so yeah, I haven't been invested either. I think I've seen all three Iron Man films, but a long time ago, and I don't remember anything beyond Robert Downey Jr.'s in them, and I think Gwyneth Paltrow's in them, and Nick Fury, Samuel L. Jackson turns up. That's all I remember about those.
Right.
I don't care. I think I saw the first Captain America. It's okay.
I haven't seen it.
I haven't seen the Avengers stuff at all, really. I was really wanting to see the Spider-Man, the most recent Spider-Man.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay.
Netflix had the Spider-Mans, and we were working up to the second one with Tom Hardy, because they're all home something, so I get them mixed up, but I think it's Homecoming. We watched that recently. And then I went to watch Far From Home, and it was gone. I think it just was a couple of days too late. It was already taken off Netflix.
Right.
So I need to see that at some point, and then I can see all the Spider-Men together.
Yeah. I mean, you need to. I went and binged all the Spider-Man MCU films last year before the new Spider-Man came out, because I wanted to follow what was going on, and I hadn't seen them all. I'd seen like one or two.
Mm.
So that was also like my way of kind of getting into the whole MCU stuff. So watching them in order, I kind of got the big thrusts. But they're all the big mix-mash films with everybody in. And Spider-Man's like a tiny bit part player in it all. And because I'd started off by rewatching the Raimi films. Mm-hmm. So I did those, and then I did the second set and then the third set. So in amongst everything else. But yeah, it paid off.
Hmm. Very excited to see the three. But I want Spider-Gwen. And I want... What other ones do I want? Yeah, I just want all the... Oh, I love Miles Morales.
Mm-hmm.
I loved Into the Spider-Verse.
It was fantastic.
I just love it. That was just a jewel. Loved it. I think that this wasn't even... It was more just, what could we both go and see that neither of us have seen yet? Mm-hmm. And we can go and see for free. Because I think there's other films out at the minute, but that we weren't allowed complimentary tickets for. So
Could have paid for a ticket, you know? I mean, it's a crazy notion.
Go to the cinema for free. Not go to the cinema for free. What's wrong with you?
Well, I mean, like, I'm missing... I haven't been to a press show now since pre-pandemic.
Yeah.
And I do miss... my weekly outings to the cinema for nothing. So I've had to pay for... I've actually gone and paid for a subscription ticket now.
Okay.
For Omniplex.
Oh, nice one.
But I'm still not... I mean, it's worked out. I've got my value for money so far.
Sure.
But I'm not using it enough.
Yeah. See, I used to do loads of stuff for QFT, Queen's Film Theatre. I was always... Well, you were as well.
So was I, back in the day.
Yeah, back in the day. I was doing it when Marion was there. I did loads of stuff, loads of voluntary work for them and everything. I even did days in the office just helping out with admin and things.
Mm-hmm.
So I just went to the cinema for free all the time for a couple of years.
Yeah.
Like exclusively at the QFT, so I still feel a bit put out that I have to pay to go to the cinema. I do things for cinema. I should go for free. Sometimes if somebody asks me what my doctorate's in and I tell them it's in film and visual studies, they go, oh, does that mean you get to go to the cinema for free all the time? Nope. Having a doctorate does not give you a free pass to anything ever.
Yeah, it doesn't, does it?
So there we are. That's that question answered.
So your listeners kind of now scribbling that one off their list. What else can we ask for?
Doesn't get you free passes.
Breaks the ice at parties.
What?
It breaks the ice at parties.
Does it?
I don't know. I don't have a doctorate, so I mean, I'm assuming it does.
I have found it can create ice.
Really?
Yeah. It can make some people feel a bit intimidated.
Because you got a doctorate.
Because it's a doctorate. But I think it's usually if people don't necessarily understand what it is. They think you're a smart person or something.
Tell them your origin story. You know, your rags to riches.
Rags to rags.
Rags to the hope of riches,
rags
followed
to different
by rags.
Rags.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe they'll kind of realize it's just a normal person.
Just still Jenny from the block, eh?
That's it. Seen how people look at you when you go down the street here?
Think you are something, do you? With your bit of paper.
Oh, now that, do you want to get into that one? About, you know, like, there is this kind of an inverse snobbery, I think, around academia from a lot of folk.
Well, from inside and outside of it, to be fair.
I mean, that's a whole other diatribe. I mean, that, you maybe want to save that one for a bit. You know, like a guest that's actually kind of got a hat in the ring.
No, but you were doing your PhD and then stuff happened and then...
I've never got back into it.
Yeah, and...
Doing the research, but I'm not in any way attached to an institution.
Yeah, I find that fascinating because you can do the research.
Yeah.
You know, I think what a lot of people don't get, and I think you only really understand this when you've got through the PhD process, all of that work, all that life and soul and effort that you put in for years of your life, it was to produce a document for examination.
Uh-huh.
And once that meeting is over, where you discuss that for an hour or whatever, that's it. That can be all it can amount to.
Uh-huh.
It all rides on that moment in time. And that decides, you know, whether you've convinced your examiners, whether you deserve a doctorate or not.
Uh-huh.
It's a fairly subjective process. And it's one that is life-changing and it alters your very psyche.
Oh.
It's not something I'd necessarily advise anyone to do. If you can do the research and you can write a book about what it is you're really interested in, if you're able to find a way and the means and the resources to do it, get on and do it. Because that's not what a PhD necessarily is.
No, we had, I was chatting to Dr. Bethan Jones on the Cinepunk podcast not that long ago.
Great, yeah.
And Bethan's just done her PhD through publications.
Mm-hmm.
So she went into it a very untraditional way. And it kind of gave me a little bit of reassurance that...
It can be done.
It can be done, but it's a hard slog as well because I think you're probably viewed slightly differently by the academic community.
Mm-hmm.
You're not a real academic because you're not doing a project as such, perhaps... But then again, it's all very tied down. You know, if you don't publish your stuff in the right places,
mm-hmm.
your work, no matter how good, is meaningless.
Yeah.
So some of the stuff that I maybe want to do in mine, you know, doesn't matter what standard I might get it to, it wouldn't count.
Mm.
So the whole thing is policed and monitored and, oh, it just seems so frustrating. I mean, I was looking, one of my friends has got just announced another publication, another big book that's taken years of work to do, and then you see the price point on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like you need a mortgage in order to buy this book.
Yeah.
The research output is inaccessible to anybody who's not part of an institution.
Yeah.
Which again sort of sits really oddly for me. I can't remember if we've talked about this before, but it sits oddly with me with this idea that education should be accessible.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is probably like working class boy for me, Belfast.
Yeah.
I still very much feel that there was opportunities that I had and I took advantage of to learn, and I think other people should be able to do that. It shouldn't be behind big glass doors.
Yeah,
or it should be, but you know, you got to make it accessible.
No, I completely agree because that's the thing. My PhD thesis, I developed it into a book and I can't afford to buy it. It's ridiculous. For a paperback, it's £45.
It's no excuse.
And that's still years after. It's now well out of date. It was published 8 years ago. And things have moved on so much because it was very much of that contemporary moment. I mean, I was publishing it and it was already out of date in parts. And now it's well out of date. So very much has changed in its topic and its landscape. And there are things that I would do differently.
Oh.
And it was what it was at its time. And it was never aiming to be a survey. It was just, this is what came up for me at that time. Mm. And, you know, I think there's still something in it. And I think if it wasn't so traumatizing to go back to, I'd probably try and do a more accessible version of it. Because it cracks me up that it's been out for such a long time. And even the ebook version of it, it's the exact same price. And yeah. I just don't understand why. But it was that urgency to publish, to get a job. Even just the crappy fixed-term jobs that were totally precarious, just to get a foot in the door with those, I had to take the contracts.
Academic publishing is a pyramid scheme.
It's horrible.
There's great work that is done within it, but ultimately, the bulk of the people who do the work don't benefit from it. And if you're in a non-funded PhD program, which I was doing, I was funding myself, so you don't get the benefit of any of that stuff.
Yeah.
So you are having to pay to do your work that you're then going to sign over to somebody else to make the money on.
Yeah.
And they do make the money on it. It's all geared in a way that they sell it to university libraries, where it's read by 5 people. It just really grates me. And it grates me having seen some of the academic contracts, the rights that people sign away.
I know.
For nothing. I mean, publishing doesn't pay the vast majority of people anyway. I mean, that's the grim reality of it, but I've seen it. And like they waive away all their rights in perpetuity. And academic publishers then will not rescind those rights in order to maintain the tiny little kind of profit margin they've got coming in. I think it's a scandal. But I'm derailing this conversation very quickly. So what do you want to talk about?
No, it's just interesting to have a general chat, because I don't know how much depth, to be fair. Yeah, to be fair to Taika Waititi and Thor, Love and Thunder, I'm not sure how much mileage she can get out of, but we can have a go. I mean, a lot of it's not without its problems. It's great crack and everything. But, you know, he does raise a child army, which I wasn't too comfortable about.
He brainwashes a child army, effectively.
I mean, he gets over his martyrdom. You think, you're just trusting those little bastards to do the right thing.
Well, I guess it feels slightly manipulative to do so. But there's also maybe an element of hope in that the battles are going to be fought by our children. You know, that they're actually the real hope for everyone. It's not us, because we've screwed up the planet, but the kids, possibly. I mean, fair enough, because of the nature of these films and these sort of comic book storylines, it is all grr war, but the kids are doing it as a last resort, but they are helping and changing things, and the adults can't do it without the kids. And I like to think, you know, as a director and as a writer, that he's a bit more savvy and liberal, and I'm maybe giving the benefit of the doubt too much.
It's a fun sequence. It's an interesting sequence, but then it did occur to me, how is this any different from what we're fighting against in certain countries where there's child soldiers and it's drugs wars and things like that, and they're relying on famines and stuff? And it's great that they've got this diversity of kids really deliberately. So they're in Asgard, which is vaguely Scandinavian. And they're all different colours, all different races and stuff, all mixed together. And that's really nice. But at the same time, you know, you're lumping all these kids and these scared kids, and their toys are becoming these deadly weapons to kill these evil creatures, you know. But it's that faceless evil. And it's not maybe necessarily that long ago that kids of certain racial backgrounds, their ancestors are that faceless evil. And so I think that there's maybe somewhere somebody hasn't fully thought that through. I don't know. Or maybe it's a way of overcoming it. I don't know how I feel about it yet, but I didn't feel good about it.
I mean, I'm not around children enough, possibly, as well, to kind of have a... to really feel about it. I think it's a valid point. In a way, I kind of... when I think about children armies and the scary children with their light-up eyes, I go back down to Children of the Damned and Village of the Damned, you know, and Midwich Cuckoos. That's where I start thinking about it. And children are scary.
They are frightening.
And they are powerful, and they do have a lot more strength. The point about the... I mean, you get that, though, with every single us and them kind of narrative, because the them is always got to be someone that's different. There's always something that separates you. You can never fight yourself, really. Yeah. And even if you fight yourself, you've got to do that under the pretense of it being something other. So I don't know how you don't, and I don't know how culturally we don't in some ways draw on decades of imagery and bigotry and bias and sort of really, really broad brushstrokes. Now, does that mean you shouldn't do it? I don't think it's a case of you shouldn't do it, but I think you kind of just need to be aware. It's a fine line for all the talk of and drive to be more progressive, which is a good thing, probably. I don't think we can stick our head in the sand and say a lot of other stuff hasn't happened, that we haven't had these historical fights. And also that there's not elements of it that aren't still true. You know, I mean, you look at what goes on in the Middle East and in sort of Eastern Europe right now, and there is a sense of that slightly faceless kind of threat. You know, we suggest entire races of people are the same. We did with Russia, with what happened in Russia and Ukraine this year.
Yeah.
Suddenly every Russian piece of artwork from the 20th century, you could no longer play. You couldn't play their music. You couldn't watch their films because they were all the other and they were all the threat. It's more nuanced than that. And I think it's okay to have that nuance. Mm-hmm. And I mean, ultimately, the main villain is played by Christian Bale.
Yeah, yeah.
He's very definitely got a face. And he very definitely has a reason.
Yes. I was going to come to that, yeah. That's the thing about the MCU and probably their slightly more peripheral works, because it was reminding me of Black Panther. The bad guy has a point, actually. And as an atheist, I kind of agree with this guy. I'm on Christian Bale's side a little bit. Kill all the gods. They're not really... They're making things worse. They're not really helping. So just pairing it back to that basic concept, you know, I thought, yeah, this guy, he's been run roughshod, like, he's not had a fun time, and it's actually quite understandable that he wants to avenge the death of his child, and not just that, but the death of his whole people. I mean, this god who just doesn't care, and, you know, is quite happy for them to die, because they're fine, you know. I suppose it's a bit like what we've been through in the UK, and what's happened, I think, over in the States, and so many places, where those who are in power in some way, who hold the power, they're having a great time. Even when they're not having a great time, they're having a way better time than the rest of us.
It's true.
So that's what we're in the UK in this moment, in summer 2022. Anyway, you know, our Prime Minister, who's not our Prime Minister but is still our Prime Minister, has had a rough year, but you know, entirely of his own making, still having a grand time. Still doing way, way better than just about everybody else in the whole country. So it felt a bit like that. It did feel, yes, there's a point there, but I did feel like Christian Bale's character, Gore, I think it was, his name is, I really did feel on his side for a lot of it. And I just thought, you all need to just sit and have a chat about this, because, you know, and Thor is the kind of hashtag not all gods kind of one who's actually trying to help, you know, but the rest of them aren't interested. You know, so I did find that quite interesting. It did remind me of, is it, what's his name? Is it Kilgrave? No, I'm thinking of Jessica Jones. The guy in Black Panther, anyway, like, he has a real point, you know, in that film. And I thought that was really important to bring in that moral ambiguity rather than just good versus bad. And, you know, you did have a lot of that language of, I'm going to go and get the bad guy in this, but I don't think he was that bad a guy. And obviously it's Christian Bale, so he is a superhero from the other universe, from the rival universe. So having played Batman for such a long time.
I think you're right. I think that nuance is being played with is important, but I think that is testament to the generation that we're in, where your villains are no longer just villains. Your good guys are never entirely good. I mean, at risk of spoiling for anyone who hasn't seen this.
We're a very spoilery show.
Or is it? Were you happy with spoilers?
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, there is a point in which Thor kills Zeus, and that is transgressive, that is bold, but also you're kind of looking, I mean, what he's doing is he's sort of punishing somebody who's an ass, who seems disinterested, but also he becomes, I mean, he's the villain, he's the god killer in that moment, and there is that observation made that, you know, they're very alike at times, And there, so you're doing exactly what you're trying to stop doing. Mm-hmm. Therefore, are you any better? No, you're not. You're, yeah. You are exactly the same.
Yeah, you're willing to kill your own.
But the motivation, mm-hmm. it was very similar too. It's like, you know, it's in the need to protect other people. It's, I mean, Beale's character is wanting to kill the gods because people are losing their lives in order to protect these people who don't care. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what's going on as well with the Asgardians. Because they're not just talking about Asgard, they're looking at the bigger picture. I suppose the global political equivalent is exactly that. It's what goes on in terms of warring countries. It's those fears, it's those leaders who will have armies go in blindly and lose themselves, but really don't care. You know, they'll they'll sit there having their Tuesday wine. What a shame it's Wednesday.
I do enjoy all the rock music. I mean, I feel like, I mean, that much Guns N' Roses. How much money does Axl Rose need at this point? Like, is he in loads of debt or something?
Probably got more surgery coming up, I don't know.
Or, you know, who's that going to? But I enjoyed it. But at the same time, I kept thinking of Megamind, because Megamind uses loads of those songs as well. I kept thinking that I can just see Megamind coming down the thing and, you know, running about the town hall and stuff. Those needle drops, those specific needle drops of all the Guns N' Roses song that are familiar to people who aren't even fans of Guns N' Roses, they feel very tired. I mean, I think they're used pretty well. They give the film energy, but I feel like if you need those specific songs, if you need Welcome to the Jungle, if you need Sweet Child of Mine, Paradise City, whatever, if you need those to give your film energy, you might need to reassess what's going on in your storytelling.
Ooh. I don't know that it needed them to give the energy, but I assumed it was part of the aesthetics of the characters. Yeah. I mean, I know that the Guardians of the Galaxy scores are, you know, the soundtracks rather than the score are kind of packed with those sorts of things.
Yeah, they are.
And the Guardians are here at the start of the film, so I mean, that kind of almost dictates the tone that you're going to have to follow on from. Mm-hmm. I mean, it didn't really bug me. I think from a really cynical point of view, it's a great way of getting the parents and the grandparents. Yeah. I mean, let's be honest, the parents and the grandparents in.
Yeah.
Because what's really scary, and I keep on saying this on social media, is that you and I are now of a generation. we could be grandparents, which is frightening. It's like my online dating life is just like gradually crawling away. It's like, no, I feel too old. You're too old. But, you know, I think that that's part of what's going on, is it means you've got that older generation come in. The kids don't necessarily know those songs, so they might be, oh god, dad listens to that. But they're loving everything else, so it kind of, it's this alchemy. It is indeed a kind of godlike magic that brings these generations together, which probably seems kind of appropriate then, when you have all these kids looking up to this older generation who also looks up to an older generation, and how that kind of feeds and cross-fertilizes. And I'm being very generous in this film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For someone who is notoriously not a fan of comic book movies.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's worth saying something about the CGI, because it is very CGI-tastic. And there were points in some of the fight sequences where I just thought, if you're going to make an animated movie, just make an animated movie. Because I'd rather just watch all animation at this point, if all I'm seeing on screen for however much a percentage of them is just animated anyway. And it's just, it's quite weightless, you know. And it's interesting because I think on, let's say, get the name right, it's Kermode and Mayo's Take, it's called now, the Wittertainment podcast. So we've been talking about this quite a lot because, you know, Mark does not like this film. He has not enjoyed this film at all. You know, there's been a lot of people kind of trying to speak up on behalf of all the visual effects artists, because it's a really tough job and there's a huge amount of them making a film like that. I think their conditions aren't very good. You know, their working conditions aren't good and they're not unionized, and they're under huge amounts of pressure to get their work done. And the average viewer doesn't necessarily know the sheer amount of stuff that goes into what we see on screen, because you've got people who work specifically on shadow, people who work specifically on one colour, people who work specifically on that light beam. It's a huge team of people making everything that you see. and you know, having to work on the characters and the costumes and the people and the movement and the weapons and the lights and all sorts of different things that have to come together, and they're under huge pressure to do it very quickly. And I think then that can lead to, there's a sense of weightlessness. Mm-hmm. There's still, I think there's still an issue when CGI has had to be rushed, even in really huge budget films, there's still an issue with that character doesn't look like they have any weight anymore. Mm-hmm. So there's no heft when they move. So it just looks animated and it looks very obvious. Whereas I think in-camera effects and special effects are, I think, are still much more realistic in that sense. You know, I get a bit disassociated when it's the CGI visual effects because there's no heft still. And so I can't really get invested because it doesn't feel like there's any real jeopardy when there's no weight to anything. I don't know if that makes sense. But I don't want to trash talk the people who make that because it's not their fault. They're doing to order what they've been told to do.
It's a nuanced conversation. I think I used to be very, very vocal in my dislike for CGI heavy films.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the problem was, I guess, you know, 15 years ago, back when I was at lab, when I was kind of full foot, CGI wasn't really advanced enough, so that unless you used it sparingly, it was really, really obvious. I think it was The Mummy, I recall, and this is like 1999 Mummy, that I recall the water in it was just so distractingly not real.
Yeah.
And stuff like that really grated me, because just use a tank, it's probably going to cost you less money and will look like actual water.
Yeah.
But the way that the technology has gone on now, it works a lot better. I mean, we were talking after the film briefly with Joanna about Ready Player One, which is all CGI, and partly because you're in a computer world, that's great. I mean, on Cinepunk not that long ago, we talked about Free Guy, which I adored, and is again a very CGI-heavy world, but you know that that's in a computer and that's how it's meant to be. I think that there's still an awful lot of CG work that gets done that the viewer doesn't recognise it as CG at all. I mean, it's quite disturbing when you see how much sometimes in the behind-the-scenes shoots is constructed in a computer or enhanced in a computer, the stuff that they wipe out of the scenes, that they bring into them. Because these are comic book movies, I have a little bit more time for it, because I realise you couldn't create those spaces physically. You could give it a go, and certainly there's going to be physical elements within those spaces. But I don't know, if you look at the big wall thing they built for Mandalorian.
Okay.
I don't know, have you watched Mandalorian at all?
No.
It's all part of the Disney Lucas universe anyway, so Marvel probably are using the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They basically have created this massive wraparound stage background, so like a 2D wall that goes all the way around, that's all full of little pixels that projects the CG images.
Mm-hmm.
In real time with the actors performing in front of them, and it is almost seamless.
Mm-hmm.
So the space is actually, the screens will move and they'll change lighting and stuff instantaneously. They'll work with the cameras and you get a much more seamless experience. And for the actors as well, what it has meant is, I mean, like Ewan McGregor famously on the Star Wars prequels hated the job because he was acting in blue screen the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing there. Whereas now he's just done Obi-Wan. And essentially, you know, we're going back to the same stuff, but the CG this time is there, that it looks convincing, and you are essentially in an actual space. I mean, I know myself from a little bit of acting work that I do.
Mm-hmm.
If you stick me in a room with a set that's been built, or there's enough there to kind of sell the illusion, in a performance, I am much more in a part of that performance than I am whenever you stick me in a blank room. Give me a black box and I'm kind of, not the black box, the black box and Belfast are very welcome to hire me for anything they want. But you put me in a black box and it is harder to kind of immerse yourself, as opposed to whenever you've got props and things that look, and I've been doing murder mysteries recently. So you're actually in the physical spaces, and that really does sell stuff for you. So with the CG, I understand that it's there for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the aesthetics of comic books, I can kind of accept it. And I thought, like, whenever they go into the Shadow Realm and something goes black and white, I thought that kind of noir-esque aesthetics was really effective.
Worked really well.
And, I mean, it reminded me a little bit of Sin City.
Oh, yeah.
You know, which was deliberately aping the comic books that it was based on. But it has that feel of a comic, you know, when you're looking through, because they are predominantly still black and white. It's not every time you'll get a colour comic.
Mm-hmm.
So that I thought worked really well.
Mm-hmm.
But also it hides a lot of the problems with the CJ in the shadows, and the shadows are in the shadows. So
I really liked that part too. I thought it was done really well, and then you do get these elements of colour because, is it Miauna, the hammer?
Mm-hmm.
Lights Jane up a bit, lights Maeutha up a bit, and you can see her face lit up, but everything else stays in black and white. I saw that was really clever, it was really well done. And yes, it does hide a lot of, you can hide things in the darkness in that, you know, so it did help in those parts that were still very CGI-tastic. And I mean, in a way, it's a nice little introduction to some people who wouldn't see a black and white film.
Yeah.
It's a nice way of just sneaking a little bit in there.
Absolutely. I think, again, it probably speaks a lot to Teggy's mentality and his sort of his influences. I mean, for what it was, I suppose it's like the issue with dodgy picture in a film. You can have a sketchy picture as long as your story and your sound is okay.
Mm-hmm.
If I can hear what's going on and I can and I've got a story that I'm invested in enough,
mm-hmm.
I'll overlook the fact that you're using Super 8 rather than 35mm, or, you know, you're using a crappy video camera, folks, rather than using, you know, the latest red cameras. I had an issue with some of the sound in this film.
Okay.
I couldn't make out all the dialogue at times.
Right.
I don't know if that just means that my ears need cleaned out, or I am getting an age and I do have tinnitus, or if it was a bad sound mix, or it could even be where we were in the cinema, the sound, you know, I was getting too much of the back speakers and not enough of the front speakers.
Yeah.
All these things can make a difference in terms of your experience. But whenever that's happening, I'm kind of struggling. So the scene, I start coming out of the film a little bit. But the dodgy CGI, I didn't even notice.
Mm.
There was enough there, and there was enough of an emotional heart for me to kind of just go on. And that, and I was laughing at the weird rock creature thing. You know? I mean, there was a lot of humour that, for me, worked. So it kept me going.
Yeah, that was something I did really, I remember enjoying about Ragnarok and Guardians of the Galaxy 2. They're really funny.
Mm-hmm.
They're riotously funny. And I appreciate that. Because it's really interesting. I haven't really seen a lot of the other stuff with Loki in it. Do like a wee bit of Hiddles every now and again. But Loki in Ragnarok, it's like Caddy brothers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've been these mortal enemies. But now they're just arguing in an elevator. And it's really funny. So, you know what, there's stuff like that. And it got silly and it stopped. It was where Marvel Universe stopped taking itself so seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciated that, you know. And I think Guardians of the Galaxy has done that really well too. It's, they're all bouncing off each other. They're all so funny with each other.
It's what separates it from the DC stuff.
I mean,
the DC stuff really was a mess for a long time. I think the hope for DC has been actually stripping it back and stop being less like a kind of nasty Marvel and actually just relish in the kind of the grimness of your simple stories.
Mm-hmm.
With the exception possibly of The Flash next year, which I'm very looking forward to.
Oh, right. I haven't been paying attention much to DC at all.
Michael Keaton coming back.
Yeah, that's quite cool.
Yeah, although there is an issue now with the kid playing The Flash and all sorts of allegations about him.
Oh, right.
But yeah,
I haven't seen anything about any of that.
I will send you some links after.
Oh, okay. I was really quite keen to see Birds of Prey.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't got around to seeing that yet, but
I enjoyed it.
It looks really fun. So maybe that's if they're moving towards something like that kind of direction, maybe that'd be interesting. But Michael Keaton again has done his turn in Marvel as well.
Vulture. Yeah.
So that was a really nice surprise when I watched that, because I just did not pay attention to Spider-Man after the Raimi films. Just in the past year caught off.
I mean, the current incumbent is a joy to watch.
Uh-huh.
I did not expect to enjoy his films as much.
Yeah.
But I got a real buzz out of them.
Yeah.
And the last of the Spider-Man movies was, I mean, it's fan service.
Yeah.
But it's,
I mean, I'm all here for it.
It
Give me Tobey back.
You know, it did the things, it tickles the thing. But also, I mean, I do think that there's been a huge part of any of those sort of things that have come up during the pandemic. We have been much more nostalgic. I think we have looked back a lot. We've looked for comfort.
Mm-hmm.
And the place of the comfort was not in the now. It was in whatever we'd had before. 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So a lot of these movies that are doing these multiverses, that are a lot of these franchises that are being rebooted with some of the old incumbents, I mean, I think that has also kind of fed into our own need to reconnect.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we always have that, but it's just, it's been really, really obvious the last couple of years.
For sure. Maybe it feels like a laboured point, but just my experience as well with the first Spider-Man, directed by Sam Raimi, that got affected by 9/11 happening. Mm. They had to change the ending of that film because it was going to involve the towers, and then they were destroyed. And then the mood of the world was very different. Certainly the mood of the Western world was very different after that. And I do feel like there was a huge shift in things in film and television. I mean, across everything, really. But, you know, I have observed as well, because I was very into 24, counter-terrorist drama, things like that. And then even things like The X-Files, when it was still being made, it got much darker than it had ever been before. And there was this turn in a lot of film and television production. And that Spider-Man, especially because of the setting, because of the New York City setting, they felt it so deeply. And Spider-Man being embraced by the city, and that city specifically feeling like it needed a hero, it in a way came out at the right time, even though it was affected by it. And I think, you know, I have always wondered if Spider-Man is that special one, because those films were, they did really well at box office. They maybe didn't, weren't received hugely well critically, but they were box office hits, all three of them. I have wondered, you know, were they embraced because of what had happened? And I think people have been doing PhDs and stuff about this. I don't know, but maybe somebody out there has investigated this properly and knows better. But I've been curious about that.
I don't know. I mean, I've been a Spider-Man lover since I was a kid.
Me too.
There are photographs from must be my fifth Christmas. And I got this giant Spider-Man figure that had suckers on it, so it stuck onto windows. I had that for years. I think the body's still knocking around somewhere. So I know that I'm inherently biased because I had a love that. I remember the TV series as a kid, and I watched the cartoons, and there were TV films as well that I remember watching. And so that was part of my memory. But also, I think I was just at the right age when those Spider-Man movies came out.
Yeah.
I was, well, the first one was 99, was it? No, it wasn't. It must have been 2000.
It was 2001. 2001.
So I was 20 when that came out.
Yeah.
I was slightly older than Peter Parker's meant to be in the narrative. And I think one of the reasons those films connect is because it's youth. A lot of the superheroes we see are old white privileged men. Up until very recently, that, I mean, Batman is the ultimate white privileged man.
Yeah.
Iron Man, white privileged man.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of money. Peter Parker is working class.
Yeah.
This is probably why I like him. He's working class. He actually has nothing.
Yeah.
He's intelligent, but he's a little bit bumbling. There's a girl he loves, but he's awkward about it. And he is clearly going through the change that we all go through as we adjust into adulthood. And that is something that I think that resonates. And I think he's got a heart that, I mean, he actually has a heart. He's allowed to show his emotions. He's not closed off in the way that some of the others were.
And he's funny.
He is hilarious. When he's played right, he is hilarious. And I think that just makes him slightly more lovable. He's the lovable rogue. And Marvel have been quite good, I guess, at capitalising on this. They've got a bit more roguish elements within everything else. But he's the sort of kid that you kind of want to...
Yeah.
As a kid, you would like him to have been your mate.
Yeah.
When you get a bit older, you think, you know what, if that was my kids or my nephew, I'd happily give him a hug and sort of like hang out with him. And I think that may be why that worked. The 9/11 stuff, yeah, you're right in terms of there was that moment and there was that feeling and there was that kind of moment at the end of the film, and it felt that, you know, they were making a statement with it. I mean, I still remember I've seen the trailer that they had where he catches a helicopter between the two towers and a web. It was definitely an element of it. But I don't know. I mean, I think we always need a hero to come. It's the escapism. We were talking about this earlier, briefly. It's the escapism that cinema offers.
Mm-hmm.
And when 9/11 happened, I think it was maybe a bit different here in Northern Ireland, where, you know, we kind of, let's be honest, were used to people getting killed on a regular basis for no good reason. And I remember thinking that at the time, that it was horrible, but it also felt kind of slightly normalised. But we look for escapism. We look for something to take us away from those kind of fears and those oppressors. And here you have something that was escapist that was also about homegrown threats, which felt, you know, like, you know, the villain that sort of sits there unnoticed, that again, you know, like everything is there. I don't know, but I haven't got a PhD, so I can't really give you a big thesis on this. I'll leave that for a proper academic.
All right, okay. Well, we'll have to find one.
If anyone knows and wants to get in touch.
I'll ask the one I live with. He's got an opinion about everything. Per Andrew. Oh, well, it's been really good to talk that stuff out, because we don't really get much of a chance to chat like that. And it's quite cool to see that we're fairly on a page with stuff, not maybe necessarily entirely in the same agreement, but enough that we don't kill each other, isn't that?
I think that's just this
my perception.
At this country, though, I don't feel like killing people. I disagree with my parents' generation on that one. I don't think that's how you solve your arguments. Absolutely, yeah. Well, just because you show, you know, all those years spent at university and the thousands of pounds that were spent on education hasn't been entirely wasted.
No, we can have a chat and sound basically like we know what we're talking about. Isn't that what podcasting is?
Four stars from me. That'll be my letterbox. I'll get a 4 stars because I enjoyed it.
I really enjoyed it, and I think it was good company to see it in. Mm-hmm. The kids had a good time.
They did.
They shut up eventually, and I think it was a wee bit scary for them.
Uh-huh.
Bits of it, because there was a bit where it was, I was thinking, oh, that might have been a jump scare there. That might have been a wee jump scare. A mild one, but a jump scare nonetheless.
I mean, it's quite good every now and then to see a film with the audience that it's presumably intended for, which is the youngsters, and we're not those anymore.
And they did settle down after. I think they did get either enthralled or bored, so...
I was just happy that you were bearable in the cinema, because that's my bugbear.
It's always a point of anxiety, isn't it? Because it's the first time we've gone to see something together.
I'm pretty sure it
and
is,
it is always like, what if this person doesn't behave themselves?
Well, this is why, like, I mean, I never recommend it for a first date, because, like...
I don't know, I think that's how you know whether they're worth a second date or not.
They're definitely not. I mean, well, it's no good, because I just want people to shut up. People who talk the whole way through a film, like those kids, would have got words.
Can't be doing with it. But I felt a bit swept up in the atmosphere, and I thought, because it's just that row of kids, and then it's us.
If they'd been behind us, I would have had an issue.
Yeah, exactly. But I actually suspect they genuinely didn't realise we were there for quite a while. And then they were starting to run in and out of the toilet, and then I think they realised, oh, there's other people here.
Bless
and
them.
They're laughing at stuff that we're not laughing at. Sam Bale, class.
He's one of us.
All these people who've just been in Jurassic Park Dominion. I haven't seen it yet either.
Have you not?
No, I'm dying to see it.
I took my mum to see it.
Oh, really?
Last week before. Because I knew she loves the dinosaur movies. And I find it perfectly fine. I mean, it's a retread of the first film in many ways.
That's all I'm looking for.
But it's... And it's not scary, even though there's more dinosaurs and they probably got more screen time, but it did enough for me.
Yeah.
Again, it's that nostalgia thing. It did enough for me to kind of make me go, that was
it's
pleasant.
It's just the gangs back together, and that's all we want, really.
Oh, it just makes me... I mean, this is the thing. I've probably talked about this before with you, about like friendships and stuff that have weathered the last few years differently, and I've made a point this year of kind of reconnecting with people.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them virtually, you know, some of them we get to do in person. But it is quite nice. It is that need to get a gang back.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Robert. This has been most enjoyable.
Pleasure.
It's been a great day. It's been lovely to make more nice memories in the Strand.
It has, yes. Yeah. It's nice to kind of get back and have a reason to.
Look at some building sites and the Ulster Unionist Party and Tesco's.
It's true. I mean, look, it's home. I mean, that's...
It's just what we are.
I for me, being here, the Strand was never a regular spot. It was somewhere I went past all the time. I mean, it's one of the things thinking about earlier when we were chatting about it. Like, I remember being a kid, driving past here and seeing the queues outside here with the 4 signs that screen 1, screen 2, screen 3, looking at these big lines and always feeling slightly envious of people getting in a big queue to go into the cinema.
Nice.
And you don't get that anymore.
Yeah,
apart from maybe a film festival, something.
Yeah.
It's the only time I ever have to queue to get into a screen. Although I've also got a lot more antisocial as I get older, so I really don't want to be sitting with that many people.
Yeah. Well, this has been great. I'm just so happy that the place has life, because I'd be devastated if something really happened to it, you know? Like,
yeah.
This has been so important to me all my life. Thank you for sharing this with me.
Pleasure. Thank you for asking.
Oh, here.
You're welcome.
Tell us where your exhibition is.
Okay, so if this goes out relatively soon, my exhibition is on at the North Down Museum, which is in Bangor Castle, Bangor, Northern Ireland. It's right at the end of a train ride, so it's dead easy. And it's actually next door to the cinema, so you can go to the cinema and look at my art at the same time. It opens on the 23rd of August, and it will run through until the 18th of September.
Okay.
So it's on for just under a month.
Brilliant.
But I will happily take my artwork to anywhere else that actually wants to do something with it.
Excellent. So, yeah. It's good for people to know if they're listening. Thank you again. Thank you so much. Thank you for tuning in to this Cozy Pea Pod production. If you got something out of this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good rating wherever you're accessing it and share it with someone you know will find it really interesting. If early releases and bonus content sound appealing, visit patreon.com/avcultures and join one of our support tiers. If you want to help the show but can't manage a membership, we'd love you to join the conversation with AV Cultures Pod on Instagram, Facebook or Twitter. The music is Common Ground by Airtone, used under a 3.0 Creative Commons non-commercial license and is available at ccmixer.org. I've been Paula Blair, and you've been a fantastic audience. Mind yourselves, until next time.